Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Happy Memorial Day. Well, for the next hour, we have a number of guests, all with their own reason to take a moment to remember. Kevin Powers, an Iraq vet, shares his remarkable story in a novel a little later with us. We also have the latest on those providing shelter and recovery from a number of storms. We'll look at how one part of the country is recovering more than 6 months from a historic storm that tore up the East Coast. And we'll take a look at present and past storms of the political kind in Washington. But today we start back in Oklahoma.
From the forecasters who issued the warnings to the first responders who dug through the rubble, to the teachers who shielded with their own bodies their students. Oklahomans have inspired us with their love and their courage.
President Obama this weekend in Moore, Oklahoma there. He singled out the bravery of a lot of local teachers, and we can speak to one of them now, Lindsay Wright, fifth grade teacher from Plaza Towers Elementary, one of the two schools destroyed in Moore last week. Hi, Lindsay.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. We do appreciate it. The president visited yesterday, of course. We've all seen the pictures of the devastation today and all week long. It's hard to believe it's been a week since those storms.
Yes. Very hard to believe.
What has your world been like?
It's been wild. After Monday, it's just been nonstop. Our district has done a great job at getting us all back together and letting us all talk about what happened and setting up times for us to meet with our students. And, of course, seven of our students didn't make it out, and it's just been filled with their services and celebrating their lives this past week as well.
We spoke the other day, Lindsay, to some high school students who had their graduation this weekend. It's a joyous time. At the same time, there's not a lot of joy at home given the services that you just described. It just must be pulling you in so many directions.
Right. It's difficult, but we have to find the silver lining in the situation and not dwell on the horrific event that happened.
Is there a plan for getting back to class with you and your fifth grade students?
Well, our school year is over for the year.
Oh, of course. I thought maybe there was one more week of June, but I guess not.
No, our last day was supposed to be last Thursday.
Okay.
So we are out for the summer.
And spending your time and energy on recovery, I guess, physical recovery for the moment, getting things cleaned up.
Yes. Physically, emotionally, mentally, everything. Everything is a mess, and so it's nice just to be able to go out and help those who can be helped salvage what they can salvage and clean up what we can clean up.
Does it make you feel a little better on a daily basis if you can go down the block and help somebody move some junk or sort of get things cleaned up a little bit?
Yeah, yes. A lot of our students lost their homes, so it's nice to be able to go and help them and see what we can do for them also during this time.
So you've got an early summer here. The rest of the country kind of celebrates the beginning of summer. What does early summer look like for you and your fellow residents there and more, do you think? Cleanup, obviously. What's ahead?
Yes, obviously cleanup and beginning rebuilding, trying to get our lives back to normal as much as possible after something like this happens.
Do you have a sense of what normal might feel like at this point? I don't know if that's a fair question.
Right now, not exactly. It's kind of hard to think about what I would have been doing today had this not happened, but we're just glad that we do have today to live right now.
Yeah, so am I. Lindsay Wright, fifth grade teacher at Plaza Towers Elementary. It's a difficult time for you, and I appreciate you taking the time to share part of your story with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So, lots and lots of work to do in Oklahoma in the coming months, for sure. We can be thankful that for most of us, our what-to-do lists for summer 2013 is not nearly as daunting. Well, here are a few of your suggestions from our Facebook page. We'll start with Kurt Kaletka, who has quite a list. Kurt says, Number one, for summer, find an ESL job for fall at one of the Boston high schools. Number two, finish writing that book, finally. Number three, manage a 50-mile bike ride in one day. Brian McCurdy says, help my wife pass the Florida bar exam. Eric Jordan has set the bar high for summer. Eric says, I want to sell my house, move somewhere else, and hit the reset button on what I want to do with my life. And Jen Holmgren is one of many who wants, quote, lots and lots and lots of trips to the beach. So for the next few minutes, we're going to take you to the beach for a look at the state of one stretch of American coast, which has undergone massive change, the New York and New Jersey shoreline. WNYC reporter Janet Babin has been traveling the length of it. Janet, welcome.
Hi.
Hi, welcome. So, Janet, where have you been? What have you seen?
Well, Todd, we've been up the Jersey Shore from Seaside Heights to points north, up through places like Long Beach, New York, and then up the South Shore of Long Island to communities in the Great South Bay. And then we went up through the Tony Hamptons all the way to the tip of Long Island to Montauk, known as the End.
So you've covered pretty much the length of the New York and New Jersey Shore. We're going to talk about the economy in a minute. But we should remind people just how much has changed physically. Much of that you can see easily with the naked eye, and some of it you can't. Here's part of your reporting from Long Beach, which you just mentioned. It starts with you talking to a local surfer. Listen.
How is it out there?
Beautiful.
Yeah?
The water's getting warmer. The waves are small, but perfect for learning.
Surf students and other visitors will notice the topography on Long Beach has changed since Sandy. The beach is now about 20 to 30 yards wider thanks to beach replenishment. Lifeguard Marvin Weiss says Sandy did damage, though, to the ocean floor.
Normally, the water, when you walk out in Long Beach, you'd walk out gradually, it would get deeper. Now it's going to get deeper all of a sudden. So you'll have a hole that you can end up being over your head.
So Janet Babin from WNYC, we're really hearing that in parts we're talking about a very different coastline from before.
Yeah, that's right. That was Marvin Weiss. This is a guy who's been a lifeguard in this community, Long Beach, New York. This is his 41st summer. So he knows this beach. He knows what Sandy did to it. And you see this up and down the coast, little changes in the topography. Things are different. Marvin Weiss told me that, you know, lifeguards are ready for this change, a deeper drop off and different breaks in the ocean from Sandy. And all up and down the coast, people are seeing these kinds of changes.
So let's talk about some of the hope versus the reality, Janet, because we've been sold an idea that things are back to normal, particularly in New Jersey, open for business. Let's hear for a minute how they're doing this, at least on television in New Jersey.
The Jersey Shore is open.
The word is spreading.
Because we're stronger than the storm.
You bet we are.
So, Janet Babin, you get to see Governor Chris Christie and his friends, whether they're actors or real friends, having fun in the sand there. But, Janet, not everything is back to normal, right? Or is it?
No, not everything is back to normal. It's really a shame because so many communities want to believe in this myth of Jersey Strong. And it's very moving. Everywhere you go, you see T-shirts with Jersey Strong and Stronger Than the Shore printed on them. But then you hit many towns, especially in the northern part of New Jersey, where time has stood still, Todd. And there are definitely changes. Appearances may be back to normal, but it's really not back to normal for many of these communities. For example, in Seaside Heights, where Governor Christie last week was opening up the new boardwalk. And the boardwalk is amazing. You know, it even has that new wood smell to it. But there are some issues. Like the town's mayor, Bill Akers, he told me he wants visitors to be ready for some of these changes from Sandy.
To be fair with our visitors, I want them to understand that Casino Pier, while you'll have part of the pier open, the front part where the games are, things like that, a lot of the rides aren't going to be open until about the middle of July.
All right, that's a fine warning for the tourists. They don't get as many rides until the middle of July. But what about the small businesses around there? They've got to be even more concerned.
The businesses are desperate to open because on the Jersey Shore, Todd, if you miss the summer season, you pretty much miss your entire year. So we saw many businesses doing their best to open or half open. In fact, One of the hotels I stayed at, the Fairbanks in Seabright, New Jersey, it was essentially a construction zone. There were more workers than guests, but the owners wanted to open up this weekend. They opened up for 12 of their guests who have this tradition of coming every year to this hotel for Memorial Day. And in fact, some of the guests actually agreed to sleep on air mattresses because the rooms weren't completely done. But they said, hey, we're going to do it just so we can be back at our Jersey Shore spot.
So there's a lot of support from the tourists there, willing to sort of do almost the extreme in their stays there. But what about the folks who live by the coast? Not the tourists, but the people who really had their homes destroyed or their lives affected. How have they rebounded since Sandy?
Well, this is a real problem, Todd. There are towns where time has just stood still. We visited places like Ortley Beach and Manaloking where it looked the same right after Sandy. You know, down some of the beach blocks, there are homes, they look like dollhouses. They have no front or back to them. Some of the homes are off kilter, and some are half standing with giant chunks missing out of them. And residents in these towns with these homes are extremely frustrated. They say their local governments are just spending all this time getting the tourists back, getting the beaches back, but they're not doing enough to help them. You know, in a town called Ortley Beach, New Jersey, there were more than 100 homes that still had to be demolished. And people in this town, Ortley Beach, are trying to get their homes back. They're trying to elevate their homes to get them up to these new flood elevation standards that they're going to have to be at if they want to get a mortgage and if they want to get flood insurance.
You know, it makes you wonder if some of the character was lost or is being lost in the reconstruction of the beaches, as charming as they always were, if they're brand new and they're not old anymore, the buildings.
That is the big fear, Todd, for many regulars. They told us, you know, with so many people unable to pay to repair their homes, they fear that a lot of chunks of the Jersey Shore are going to be, you know, auctioned off to the lowest bidder, to investors or big developers who are going to come in and change the character of beach towns that in some cases, you know, generations of families return to these vacation spots every summer. And that's why we see these pockets where people are just adamantly supporting their beach town no matter what. In Seabright, New Jersey, where I told you we stayed at that hotel that was more like a construction zone, but we were happy to be there. You know, many of the seaside bars in that town are not back. So it used to be, you know, you'd have a tiki bar on the beach, no more. But we still had locals and visitors who were determined, and they were on the beach last week, despite the clouds, despite the chilly weather, and despite this lack of tiki bars.
Do it. Come on, polar bear plunge. Come on. January 1st, you'll jump in, but you won't jump in now.
Jump in again.
Come on.
Well, Janet Babin, if you're from Pennsylvania like me and you go to the Jersey Shore, they call you a shoobie because you bring your lunch in a shoebox, or at least you used to. So that's hope versus reality, reconstruction versus rustic feel versus history. Janet Babin is a reporter for our co-producer, WNYC. Thank you, Janet.
Thank you, Todd.
You can get full details of her reporting and much more about the state of New Jersey and New York and the shore post-Sandy at thetakeaway.org. Republicans this weekend kept up the pressure on the administration, calling for a special prosecutor to investigate the Justice Department's monitoring of journalists' records and the IRS targeting of conservative groups. Now, talk of possible criminality at the IRS and overreach at the Justice Department has led some in the GOP to make comparisons to 40 years ago. Tenuous? Well, here's something to help you decide for yourself. May 1973, then, just like now, we were dealing with confrontations in the Middle East. We were on the cusp of an economic recovery. But the problem was that that recovery was slow and tepid and weak. Sound familiar? Only at the heart of this scandal was a president directly orchestrating and conspiring against his political enemies. And it all played out in front of the cameras when the Watergate Committee hearings began almost 40 years ago.
Mr. Butterfield, are you aware of the installation of any listening devices in the Oval Office of the President?
I was aware of listening devices. Yes, sir.
When were those devices placed in the Oval Office?
Approximately the summer of 1970. I cannot begin to recall the precise date. There was no doubt in my mind that they were installed to record things for posterity.
On whose authority were they installed, Mr. Butterfield?
on the president's authority by way of Mr. Haldeman and Mr. Higbee.
Alexander Butterfield, an aide to President Richard Nixon, being questioned before a Senate investigative committee in June 1973.
I can flatly say that the president was not involved in any cover-up of anything at any time.
Here was H.R. Haldeman almost exactly 40 years ago, protecting the president before he would eventually go to jail for his own role in Watergate.
I maintain the standards of integrity, that I've always set for myself and that the president set for us. And I feel equally assured and certain that there will be no question as to any inappropriate or improper involvement of the president in any matter related to the Watergate at any time, in any way.
Watergate and the hearings and trials that followed and the resignation of a disgraced president defined political scandal for this country. It is a definition that stays with us to this very day. We even attach gate to dust-ups now, regardless of their size or scope. Seriousness.
Look, I hope you're sitting down. There's a new scandal rocking my kitchen rules. It's called Pastagate.
But then you realize the Washington I was talking about before, a reelected president, a second term, a weak and tepid economic recovery, a capital descending into scandal, we wouldn't be the first to draw a parallel with much more recent events.
I didn't have all the facts. I didn't know what was on the list, exactly how it was used. Were there liberal groups as well as conservative groups? I didn't have the facts. I didn't have anything concrete. I didn't have a full set of facts to come back to Congress or the committee with.
That's former IRS Commissioner Douglas Shulman speaking last week in front of a congressional committee. Shulman's replacement at the IRS was Stephen Miller. Here he is being questioned by Congressman Dave Reichert of Washington State.
Mr. Miller, you're the commissioner. Who is responsible? You conducted the investigation. Who was responsible?
I don't have that name, sir. I tell
you. Why don't you have
that? I was originally.
Have you asked anybody? Who's responsible?
I don't remember, to be honest with you.
You don't remember again.
Shulman and Miller don't have a lot of answers. And in this country, 40 years later, thanks to Haldeman and Dean and Ehrlichman and Nixon and others, hearing a government official say, "I don't know" or "I don't recall" fits into one box in the public psyche, the Watergate box.
This is both an ongoing matter and an ongoing matter about which I know nothing. I don't know what has happened in this matter. I did not know.
Now here's the Attorney General himself, Eric Holder, asked last week in front of the very same Judiciary Committee that helped investigate Watergate what he knows about his Department of Justice spying on the phone records of reporters from the AP.
We don't have a factual basis to answer that question. I don't know. Good question, and I'm not sure what the answer is. Don't remember that, no.
It doesn't take a big leap of the imagination to recall the previous outrage at what was then seen as the very worst example of government overreach and abuse of power.
It reeks of the worst kind of totalitarianism. It reeks of what would be in another country called a police state. And I'm flabbergasted that this kind of activity has been going on at the summit of government, the White House. What a poor example to set to all citizens on the right of privacy.
That's Senator Henry Scoop Jackson speaking 40 years ago. Now, there's no evidence right now that IRS employees targeting the Tea Party or the Justice Department investigating journalists or Benghazi amount to anything near what happened 40 years ago in Watergate. The break-in, the use of direct presidential power against political enemies, the cover-up, the resignations.
Throughout the long and difficult period of Watergate, I have felt it was my duty to persevere, to make every possible effort to complete the term of office to which you elected me. In the past few days, however, it has become evident to me that I no longer have a strong enough political base in the Congress to justify continuing that effort.
But what took place 40 years ago bears a second, third, or fourth listen today. Back in 1973, Senator Sam Ervin said the presidency and Washington was sick, gravely sick.
We don't like the surgeon's knife, but sometimes it comes a cancer. That the only way you can eradicate it is by the use of the surgeon's knife. And I think you can have such a thing as a cancer on the body politic that has to be eradicated the same way. And I'm frank to state, and I'm not stating this in nature of a threat, but I've been given, as chairman of that committee, a mission performed.
The White House today is doing its best to move on. It's not doing a very good job. Based on what we know now, it's at best a stretch to draw too much of a line between Washington in the summer of 2013 with the political climate generated in 1973. 40 years ago, Sam Ervin said Washington had a cancer. But with the flashbacks and the memories and the anxiety, Washington seems to have something more like a four-decade-old lingering case of post-traumatic stress. The usually peaceful Swedish capital of Stockholm has seen a week of intense rioting and unrest. Over the last week in the city's suburbs, rioters have set cars and schools on fire. And to get a sense of what's causing the unrest, I've been talking to Marcus Brixworld. He's in Stockholm and for years has been working as an advisor to the Swedish government.
Well, it seems like there is quite a complex background situation that we're talking about. In the suburbs, of course, we have a lot of social economic problems that have built the background for the situation. But one should also remember that so far, most of the people that has been arrested so far, it's about 20 youngsters so far, a majority of them have earlier convictions also when it comes to drugs, crimes, etc. So there is a hardcore of criminals that are kind of taking initiatives and leading this process. But they also have a followers of youngsters that are more or less, you would say, unemployed. They have a social problems and so on. But at the same time, we are in a situation where people also have a lot of, well, socioeconomic problems in these areas. So there is a combination of both, you would say.
Marcus Brixworld, is this an issue of immigrants mostly? Are the opportunists, the gangsters you talk about, sort of fomenting unrest with immigrants or people without economic opportunity who have legitimate grievance? I'm trying to get a sense of who, what exactly might be pushing people into the streets, or at least what perceived problems.
So what you see, this is not just a question about ethnical background or anything like that. It is taking place in these rural areas, but they are, of course, of social economic backgrounds. And they are kind of inspiring a lot of youngsters from different social backgrounds and different economic backgrounds.
Now, I have to say, a year or a year and a half ago, we saw similar riots in London and a couple of other cities in the UK. We've seen them in France at times with people of Algerian descent especially, or Palestinian people upset with their social conditions in France, some riots in the streets there. I got to say, Marcus, Sweden, Stockholm, you know, we thought that there was sort of a social utopia there in Stockholm. Yeah. I think it's a little surprising what you're saying.
Of course, the situation in Stockholm doesn't differ from other countries in the way that we have, for example, a high degree of unemployment when it comes to youngsters. Of course, it is far away from the situation where we have in for example, Spain. But we do have an unemployment rate among youngsters. And we have what you would see, a division in our society that is kind of increasing when it comes to incomes, when it comes to health, when it comes to living conditions and so on. So, of course, there is a background. It goes hand in hand with circumstances that are very similar in many other parts of the world. But one should also remember that the situation here is not similar at all when it comes to other countries, when it comes to, for example, social economic situations. We have a welfare system in a high degree that do take care of a lot of social problems. But of course, there is a changing picture and the globalization and so on. Every country, we are having a more openness. You will see people, you can see these conditions around in the world, and you will see the similarities, absolutely.
Changing social conditions, difficulty with them, and some trouble in the streets in Stockholm. Marcus Brixworld in Stockholm, thank you.
Thank you very much.
The countdown is over. It's been 7 long years for fans of the TV series with the ultimate cult following. Of course, I'm talking about Arrested Development. Yesterday, 15 new episodes released exclusively on Netflix. And if Twitter, Facebook is any indication, and it is, hardcore fans did not leave their houses all day. This includes our own Kristen Meinzer. Kristen, I understand you spent all weekend with Arrested Development?
All weekend. Me and the Bluths and all of our dysfunction.
All right. Well, since you spent all weekend with Arrested Development, and I confess I've never seen the show, I am useless to you right now. So I'm just going to take myself out. I'm going to hand things off to you and to Will Leach. He's contributing editor for New York Magazine. Earlier this month, Will wrote a piece called The Persistent Cult of Arrested Development. I'm useless to you. I leave it to you, Kristen, please.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Todd. And Will, thank you so much for being here.
Of course. Thanks for having me. I will talk about Arrested Development forever.
Well, you just wrote this great article on Arrested Development and the persistent cult of Arrested Development. Why do you think that this show, of all the hundreds of thousands of TV shows that we've had all over the world over the last several decades, why does this one have such an extreme cult following?
Well, it had two major things in that one, it was densely packed with a lot of in-jokes that only devoted fans could have and that would get and understand. And the other thing was that it was taken away from them at the wrong time. Even the intro of the new shows talks about how, you know, the show was the family whose future was abruptly canceled. Like, people are still sore about having this kind of world taken away from them. And I think that's the sort of thing that really creates a cult. It's not just having that kind of love for the show, but having it kind of taken away by mean people in suits.
And let's remember also, when the show went off the air 7 years ago, this is the very last thing that we heard was a hint that it was not gone forever.
And maybe pitches her TV show to a Hollywood icon who says,
"No, I don't see it as a series. Maybe a movie."
So, Will, that hint there that it might turn into a movie someday, but actually it's on Netflix right now. How do you feel about this format change? Because going from network TV to Netflix kind of opens some doors and it might close some others. What do you think about it?
Well, you know, in a lot of ways, it was probably the best way to get it back. I think certainly a lot of people that were so sad to see it gone in the first place, we would have taken it in any format. I am three episodes in. I don't know how many you are in.
I watched it all.
That's amazing. And I actually was going to do that. And then I saw an interview with Mitchell Hurwitz where he made a good point, because I watched a lot of the second and third seasons I'd seen them, of course, but I wanted to refresh and everything. And it is true, like he said, that after about five or six, funny things start to feel a little less funny just because you're just kind of in this kind of run forward thing. But I like the idea that of the ones I've seen, I love that they're longer. I like that they're packing more information and they're packing more story into it, particularly because it makes the show feel like a little less frantic than maybe the first version did.
Yeah, in some cases, the episodes are as long as 37 minutes as opposed to the old 22.
Yeah, and it feels like – because one of the things about – the original show, it felt so packed with jokes. They were bursting at the seams. It felt like they were trying to put the lid on this. These jokes are popping out of this 22-minute format. I've found the new episodes a little slower and a little more lived in, which I think is probably a difference from what people might be used to.
Yeah. Well, let me just ask one last question before we go. With all of the buildup for this series and people waiting so long for these episodes, there have been some mixed reviews online. Do you think that maybe everyone's build up, they have just expectations that are a little bit too high?
Oh, I mean, it was impossible for them to people to meet any information. I mean, it feels weird just seeing the actors look older. Things are different. I think it was inevitably people were going to have some sort of reaction. I'm still early on enough. It's just a different paced series than it was initially, and I think that's going to be an adjustment. But to me, I'm just grateful to have these guys back.
Oh, I actually have to say I'm grateful to have them back too, and I really held my tongue to not give any spoilers today. But and I'm glad you did too, Will. Thank you so much for being here.
Of course, thanks for having me.
I'm grateful to have the two of you, because I am shamed that I've not watched Arrested Development. I promise to watch it. I was late to the game with Game of Thrones. I'm caught up. Late to the game with Boardwalk Empire. I'm caught up. Arrested Development. Kristen Meinzer, this is my promise to you in public. I promise. I'll watch it.
I take that promise. And I will challenge you to that.
Kristen Meinzer is our culture producer and progenitor of the Movie Date podcast here on The Takeaway. Will Leach is a contributing editor for New York Magazine. Thanks, guys, for helping me.
Thanks, Todd.
Let me take you back to one of our guests that we had on the program before the weekend on Friday. We spoke to James Dale. He was kicked out of the Boy Scouts when the Scouts discovered he was gay. He filed suit against the Scouts, and eventually in the year 2000, he made his case in the U.S. Supreme Court in the landmark case of Boy Scouts of America v. Dale. He lost, and he was, of course, talking to us about the decision by the Scouts before the weekend to lift the ban on gay members. Listen.
The Boy Scouts say they want this issue to go away. It's not going to go away, not because of me, but because America will not tolerate this type of discrimination against sort of people they know and love, their brothers and sisters. And the Boy Scouts have just taken a step, not necessarily a step forward, but a step to try to do something about the hemorrhaging loss of members and dollars.
The issue is not going to go away, says James Dale, and at least in the state of New York, he may be right. New York State Senator Democrat Brad Hoyleman of Manhattan also believes that that decision by the Scouts is not enough because while the vote allows openly gay Scout members, it does not allow openly gay adults to be their leaders. And Senator Hoyleman says that's reason enough to take away the Boy Scouts tax-exempt status in his state. He joins us now. Senator, hello.
Hello, Todd.
Good to have you. Now, Senator, the Scouts vote was historic, allowing gay members for the first time, a resounding vote. But rather than celebrating, why are you introducing this legislation to take away their tax-exempt status? Why now?
Well, Todd, the decision doesn't go far enough. It does not include banning discrimination of gay and lesbian adult leaders in the Boy Scouts of America.
And do you have – is there something already in New York law that – says to you that they, on that basis, deserve to have their tax-exempt status taken away, or is this something you're trying to exact by changing the law?
Well, absolutely. We have a state human rights law in New York that prohibits discrimination based on sexual orientation, and it's my firm belief that the Scouts are in violation of that statute.
Now, of course, as you know, in the Supreme Court case, Boy Scouts versus Dale, we just talked to him there in the intro and before the weekend, they ruled that the Boy Scouts of America is a private organization that has the right to include and exclude whomever they like. You might be part of a private club that maybe does a similar thing on a different basis, not on sexual orientation. But if they're a private club that can exclude people as they like, according to the Supreme Court, then legally, what's wrong with it?
Well, that was a narrow ruling, and that was back in the year 2000. I think a lot of opinions have evolved. We've seen great progress in terms of LGBT equality with marriage, with civil rights across the country. And I believe that it's time for the New York State Legislature to step in where the Supreme Court of the United States failed to protect our rights as citizens in this country.
State Senator Brad Hoyleman is a New York State senator representing Manhattan. He's a Democrat. Senator, if the Boy Scouts of New York, the Boy Scouts of America of New York, lose their tax-exempt status, it becomes a lot more expensive for them, of course, to conduct business. Somebody might react and say, you're just trying to take them down. You're just trying to ruin some of these organizations now because you're mad at the national leadership.
What I'm trying to do is provide some rationale for tax-exempt statuses for organizations. We provide these for religious organizations, for charitable organizations, for youth organizations. And the idea is that we're supposed to encourage civic behavior. And in my opinion, when you deny adults the opportunity to serve as leaders and scout troops just because they happen to be gay or lesbian, it sends a terrible message to young people, to adults, across the state of New York and, frankly, across the country. You know, Todd, just about a week ago, a 32-year-old man was killed in Greenwich Village in a hate crime. And I believe by the Scouts continuing this terrible discrimination against adults, we're basically empowering those folks who want to bash gay men and women on the streets of this country, and we're demonizing young boys who may be gay by virtue of no choice of their own.
James Dale, Senator, when he was in the Boy Scouts, was a scout in good standing, I think, from when he was 8 years old to when he was an Eagle Scout and was then, of course, forced out as an adult. One of the things he said, and you heard him in the cut there, was that this is a matter of time, that the position that the Boy Scouts has taken, which is gay kids okay, gay adults not, essentially you're out of the organization on the morning of your 18th birthday if you're gay, isn't sustainable. It's just not tenable, and that it's a matter of time before this sort of shaky decision comes down to welcoming everybody into the Scouts, that it's just a matter of time. What do you think about that notion?
I think he's right, and I think we're seeing that evolution, and it's happening more rapidly than I think many people in this country would like. But I'm certainly very happy to see it evolve as quickly as it is. You know, it's based on the discrimination currently is based on this myth that men who are gay are predators. And that's what's so depressing and offensive about the Scouts decision. They are perpetuating the lie that adults who are gay or lesbian somehow are going to take advantage of young people. And we cannot, Todd, let that stand.
Senator Brad Hoylman of Manhattan, a Democrat in the New York State Senate. Senator, you were an Eagle Scout, is that right?
That's right. And
you're also gay, is that right?
Yes.
So what was your experience before we let you go? Just let us in on what it's like for you.
Well, I find it incredibly offensive that I could receive the highest rank in scouting and be a citizen in good standing in my community, yet I cannot be a leader in a troop in the local New York City area because I am gay. And it's not only offensive to me as an Eagle Scout, it's offensive to me as a father of a two-year-old and as a member of the New York State Senate. I think we need more people, frankly, like me or James Dale, leading troops in this country.
State Senator Brad Hoylman is a Democrat from Manhattan. He is an Eagle Scout. He is also gay. He is also the father of a two-year-old, which I think you may have heard in the background there. He is also introducing a bill to remove the Boy Scouts tax-exempt status, at least in the state of New York, after their decision to allow gay Scout members but not gay Scout leaders. Senator, thank you.
Thank you so much, Todd.
From Eric Maria Remarque's All Quiet on the Western Front to Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried, the combat novel takes its readers right into the action, into the horrors of war. Well, according to a lot of the critics, what Remarque did for World War I and O'Brien did for Vietnam, the recent novel The Yellow Birds has done for Iraq. Author Kevin Powers served in Iraq in 2004 and 2005. In The Yellow Birds, Powers traces the story of 21-year-old Army Private John Bartle after he's returned from serving in Al-Tafar in Iraq. And Powers explained to us how his service influenced Bartle's story.
The specific events of the story are imagined. I mean, it's entirely a work of fiction, but the internal life of the narrator certainly parallels my experience to a certain degree. I had many of the same questions and concerns that he has, experienced similar shades of sort of loneliness and regret. And, you know, that was really the kind of the core of what I was trying to talk about in the book.
There are sort of the moral questions and the internal questions. But then in this book, there's also a lot of stark realism that I was struck by, bringing me, us, the readers, right into combat in a very real and gritty way. Soldiers on amphetamines rubbing Tabasco sauce in their eyes, staying up all night shooting at people they don't know if they're civilians or soldiers. There is a realism to it that is jarring.
Right, and particularly given the kind of the register and the tenor of the language of his reflections, I wanted those moments to stand in really stark relief and to be unadorned in that way so that it would hopefully be jarring in that way and be surprising and unsettling. And I mean, I think there's a way in which we become inured to these images of violence and the understanding that it's going on because we're exposed to it. So one of the challenges for me was to try to find a way to make that unsettling again. And it seemed that just by stripping everything away from those scenes of violence and distress would be a way that I could hopefully reintroduce people to the real suffering and violence that's taking place in places like that around the world.
Kevin Powers is author of Yellow Birds, a fictional memoir. It's a novel, but in a way a fictional memoir of the war in Iraq. Kevin, what about your own service? You went to the Army in 2004, is that right? You went to Iraq in 2004?
That's right, yeah, early 2004. Yeah, and I was a machine gunner for a combat engineer platoon. Our primary responsibilities were looking for the roadside bombs, the IEDs. Yeah, we were kept very busy, as you can probably imagine. I mean, we did. We had a lot of missions there, pretty much constant. The mental exhaustion I describe in the book is something that that I experienced firsthand, and trying to communicate that to people who want to understand that experience on an individual scale and a human scale was something that felt really important to me.
Trying to put the reader in a place of experiencing the boredom, the horror, the realism of combat is something other authors have done. And critics are putting you up there right away with books like A Farewell to Arms or The Red Badge of Courage, classics on personal realism of combat. It might be too early to ask you if you think the comparisons are apt, but it's quite a place to be.
Well, of course, it's gratifying and flattering, but thankfully I don't feel the need to be accountable to the comparisons that other people make. So, yeah,
no, and you shouldn't, and yet those are books that are classics for that very reason, for putting the reader in combat with a sense of realism, a way that doesn't allow the reader to be at arm's length from war in a way that so many other media do.
That's true. And I mean, I think that's one. I mean, obviously, understanding the big picture, understanding the kind of political ramifications, that's essential, absolutely essential. But there is something that the imagination can do, that imaginative literature can do, like novels and poems, to give people a connection, again, on this kind of person-to-person basis where you're seeing hopefully what it's like to be a person in these extraordinary circumstances and just how difficult it can be.
Those other books that I mentioned that people inevitably make the comparison now, The Red Badge of Courage, The Civil War, Farewell to Arms, World War I, have you learned anything through reading those books or reviewing them, some of the critical differences between the war in Iraq and those previous wars that have been written about? Of course, technology is different, and in another way, they say all war is the same. It's hell. How do you think you can differentiate between this modern warfare experience and maybe the wars of the past?
Well, you know, I think in there are certain aspects of the experience that probably are universal. The fear, the sort of emotional intensity, that probably doesn't change from war to war. But I think the differences start appearing when you think about the kind of involvement of the nation as a whole, the degree to which the nation is either involved or not involved, whether or not the cause is just. I mean, that's a real question that I think makes a difference in I mean, not only in our kind of national consciousness, but also in the minds of the soldiers who are asked to fight. You know, it matters whether you know, for instance, my grandfather, as awful as his war experience was, the cause was clearly just. That hasn't always been the case over the last, say, 40 to 50 years.
And many people think in this case, of course, as history is writing the history of the Iraq War, that the justness of the cause is certainly in question, to say the least. I had one other thing I wanted to ask you about before we let you go, Kevin Powers. I have never been in combat myself. One thing that happens on Capitol Hill in the political world where I work is that soldiers from Walter Reed Army Medical Center come around every day, mm-hmm. and are given tours by the tour guides. They wheel around and they go around on their crutches. Lawmakers come up and sign their casts and sign autographs and pieces of paper for them. Many of these soldiers, of course, are missing limbs or have had TBIs, traumatic brain injuries, maimed in various ways. And they meet the politicians who, in many cases, voted to send them into those very wars. It breaks your heart to see it from a distance, and it happens every day.
You know, I think for me, when I reflect on my experience and the people that I served with, the vast majority of people who serve do so with honorable intentions, the best intentions. They do so because they care about their family and their neighbors and their community and their country. And I just wish that that our politicians would reflect on the great sacrifice these people are willing to make before they ask them to make it.
And one wonders every time they sign an autograph if those politicians are reflecting on those decisions. One does indeed. And you have to reflect on those decisions if you read The Yellow Birds by Kevin Powers. It is a fictional war memoir, a novel that takes you right inside combat in the worst way in the war in Iraq and the aftermath. Kevin Powers, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, on this particular day, this Memorial Day, we want to thank Kevin Powers for his service, and we want to thank all of those who serve on this Memorial Day. Thank you. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything else on the show, you can check us out, as always, at thetakeaway.org. Our number, 8778-MY-TAKE, is a place for you to share your stories or weigh in on whatever you might have heard or what you would like to hear on the program. We always want to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening. Enjoy your day off and your Memorial Day. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.